Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. According to Now This, protests and actions over police brutality are happening in over 540 cities across the country, and there is no end in sight. Just in the Bay Area, there are at least 10 protests or actions taking place every single day. So how can we use this moment to create systemic change? Today, we are joined by John A. Powell, professor of law at UC Berkeley and director of the Othering and Belonging Institute. In a recent piece, Professor Powell writes, "We should protest, we should organize, we should demand that police departments across the country be held accountable when they violate the law. But we also need to remember that policing is but a single component of the larger system of oppression so acutely felt in the Black community. That means we simultaneously need to continue to fight for housing justice, school reforms and integration, job opportunities, and healthy neighborhoods. We are not just fighting for justice in our relationship with the police. We are fighting for the full humanity of Black people." John A. Powell is professor of law, African American, and ethnic studies at UC Berkeley. He's director of the Othering and Belonging Institute at UC Berkeley. It's a research institute that brings together scholars, community advocates, and policymakers to identify and eliminate the barriers to an inclusive, just, and sustainable society and a more equitable world. Professor Powell is the author of several books, including his most recent, Racing to Justice, Transforming Our Conceptions of Self and Other to Build an Inclusive Society. Professor Powell has also done extensive research looking at racism in the United States, Brazil, and South Africa. Hi, Professor Powell. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I just wonder what you're thinking about where we are right now. I mean, we've never seen anything like this. Over the past few weeks, I've been saying there are protests happening in towns I've never heard of.
Yeah, it's actually an incredible time we're in. I mean, I was in the 1967 protests in Detroit and have witnessed several since then, and we've never had anything like this. And part of the difference is just the rapidity, how fast it's happening, but also how many people are involved. And literally, it's multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-religion, and it's global and multi-sector. I mean, oftentimes when there's protests like this, especially around a police shooting, this is blue wall. This, the backstop are mayors and other police chiefs and the business community. And there's still some of that, but there's also General Mathis, there's also Mitt Romney, there's also so there's people from all over. There's the NFL, and then of course the Black community itself. I was looking this morning getting ready for the talk, and when Ferguson happened, Michael Brown was killed, only 40% of Americans were comfortable with the term Black Lives Matter and the protest. Today it's 74%, including the majority of Republicans. So something has happened. I mean, that's a huge shift. Now, it doesn't mean that it will translate into systemic, sustainable change. We have to make that happen. But it is an opportunity.
It is a huge opportunity, Professor Powell. And I'm wondering, why do you think that the killing of George Floyd created this historic moment? There have sadly been so many deaths on camera, but we're so glad those cameras are out there, because if it weren't for that young woman videotaping George Floyd, we would probably never know his name.
Yes, I think that's true. I think there are a number of reasons, and you know, we'll never know for sure, but first of all, we're in the middle of a pandemic. And so Americans and people all around the world are sort of more or less sheltered in place, feeling a little antsy. And what the pandemic does as well, what the coronavirus 19 does, it actually creates a space where we can sort of rethink many of our institutions, rethink how we're connected to each other. And that pandemic was already shining a light on. I mean, early on, Governor Cuomo said the pandemic is the great equalizer. Well, it turns out it's not. When you see the deaths of Blacks, the deaths of Native Americans, the deaths of immigrants, it turns out that because of how people are situated, the pandemic is having a very unequal effect. When we say wash your hands, and we say 30% of Native Americans don't have running water, when we say shelter in place and homeless people don't have any place to shelter. So we're already grappling with that. And one of the things the pandemic also showed is that it's hard to really separate from each other. You know, like, we're connected. We're social beings. So we're dealing with that, and we're feeling the stress of that. And then, you know, frankly, we had this event in Central Park, which was fascinating. And I wrote a little bit about it. Because Amy Cooper, a middle-class white woman, knew that she could threaten a black man by saying, I will call 911 and tell him an African-American man is threatening my life and my dog. She knew that she could call the state, she could call the system to visit harm, if not death, on black bodies. And again, that's captured on film. And while we're still processing that, then we have Derek kneeling on George Floyd's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, very dispassionate. So oftentimes the story is that, you know, the police was threatened, we don't have all the facts, person had a gun, they were resisting arrest. All of those stories were washed away. We watched for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, police dispassionately, with his hands in his pocket, being very relaxed, with people saying, stop, you're killing him. And I think that all those things coming together had a huge impact. It was hard to deny. I have a neighbor who, a moderate, conservative, elderly white man, who is furious. It's like, I didn't know there was this kind of discrimination. I didn't know this kind of violence. And in a sense, not only was he affected, he was actually pissed and hurt. This is not the America he thought he was living in. Yeah. And then I think the fact that we have basically Trump in the White House, who has a very hostile position to black people, and will call out and to people who are not in his camp. So the fact that he would talk about this in the way that he talks about it, I mean, he created an environment. You know, I've been playing with the idea that there's a backlash to the backlash. And I think most people, when they have good information, white, black, Latino, otherwise, really want to do the right thing. They may not know how, and they may not disagree on information, but now the information is right before us.
Professor Powell, to add to the list that you just cited with Audrey Cooper, George Floyd, and you write about this in a recent piece, you also write about Ahmaud Arbery, and we should mention Ahmaud because that also happened over this short time frame. We saw the horrific video of him jogging down a road in Georgia, right. Being killed by a white man, and then his father was also involved.
That's right. And you know, the sad thing is, even as we protest, we're still seeing killings continuing to happen. There was a Latino man killed here in Oakland a couple of days ago. Every day, it's like you would think that the police department would at least know, okay, well, they're being scrutinized now. They should change, at least for the length of time they're being watched. But they can't, right? I mean, it's like it's so deeply ingrained in their culture. And I think that's why people are calling for a radical change in the way we think about policing.
I also want to mention that on Twitter, a number of Native people are talking about their loved ones killed by police, but they don't have the video. And so we don't know their names. And they're trying to get their loved ones' cases more attention.
No, that's you know, I just got off a call with a major tech company, and I was talking about one of the things that's different and that they can do is help make this information available. You know, for some people, it won't matter. You have the people who don't care. You have the frat boys and some of the police actually mimicking with a knee on someone's neck. Forget about those right now. That's the vast minority, I think. But when people have the information, and unfortunately, there are too many communities, and part of our structural racism, if you will, and structural and cultural racism, is we don't know what's happening with Native Americans. We don't know what's happening with in the Latino community. Until very recent, you know, I grew up when watching a television that was overwhelmingly white. if you saw a person of color, they were in a unflattering role. You know, we just had our first superhero with the black lead. So I think, you know, there are many aspects to this, and many people who are invisibilized, whether it's Native Americans or whether it's the trans community, and sort of bringing people out of the light into the light. You know, we can't address these problems until we actually shine a light on them.
Right. And also to connect the dots, Professor Powell, and I would love for you to talk with us about that. How can we take this moment and move it forward? What lessons can we learn from the civil rights movement, both from its shortcomings and its strengths?
Well, you know, I think that's a great question. The civil rights movement did a lot, and people sort of, you know, said nothing's changed. Things did change. I mean, I'm old enough to have remember being conscious before the civil rights movement, and really things have changed, but not nearly enough. And then the reality is we've been backsliding. It's not simply that we slowed down. You know, we are watching a Congress and a White House that's rapidly taking away civil rights, a Supreme Court that's hostile to the rights of people to vote. And so we have to be vigilant. We have to stay out there. But one thing that happened in the midst of the civil rights movement, frankly, and it's a little bit controversial, but I'll name it. There was you had King, you had Stokely, you had an upswing of the Black Power movement. And in a sense, the movement actually had a marginal role for white people. It's not that white people necessarily want to play a major role, but Stokely was saying, go work in your own community. You know, and we literally stopped having white people participate at the level that they could have and should have. Mm-hmm. And to me, the ability to bridge with other communities while keeping a focus on anti-black racism is critical. We simply don't have the power in terms of the vote, economically or politically, to actually do this by ourselves. We need to lead it. We need to have a very clear voice. But we actually have to have other people involved as well. And I think we're doing that right now, but it's what I call a wobbly bridge. There is solidarity, but we haven't practiced it long, so we're not good at it. It could easily fall apart. But that's one of the real dangers. Can we keep this energy, this solidarity, these bridges growing and getting stronger? And if we don't do that, then it'd be hard to sustain.
To that point, Professor Powell, I watched this talk that you gave at UC Berkeley. I believe it was late last year. Excuse me. And you talked about working on the Voter Restoration Act in Florida, which would allow people with prison records to vote. This is major disenfranchisement. We're talking about 1.4 million people. And you pointed out that in order to restore votes in Florida, you had to get 60% of the overall vote. And there just weren't enough Black and Latinos in Florida to get to 60%. So you all realized, especially the people in Florida, that you had to reach out to white voters. I thought this was a really interesting story. Can you share it again?
Yes. Yeah, so it was actually fascinating because it even goes beyond voting. But so there was one of the people who was the head of the Florida Restoration Act, basically restoring the right to vote to people who had been enfranchised. It was a young African-American organizer, Bernie supporter, urbanite, very progressive. And he partnered with a young white organizer who was a Trump supporter, rural, very conservative. They came together and they talked about that this was not about Trump or Bernie, left or right. This is about human dignity. This is about all of us having the right to express our full humanity. We may express it differently. We may disagree, but we all have that right. They went around Florida together and did something that all the pundits said was impossible. They galvanized the people. In some ways, to me, it's analogous of the marriage equality, when people sort of pivot to the right to love. It's sort of deeply grounded in a human emotion. They won. the African Americans still did not have the right to vote because the Florida legislature then said if you had any fines, you can't vote. And so they still were going around the state. And they made it clear their goal was not simply restoring the right to vote. The goal was restoring human dignity. Mm-hmm. And someone said, so what's your communication strategy when you're talking to a conservative? And they said, our communication strategy is love. And so they're really trying to do something even more profound than restore the right to vote. To your point, though, this was the largest voter enfranchisement since women were given the right to vote in 1920. It's huge. As you said, 1.4 million people. So but it shows working together, what we call bridging, and building a larger we, where everybody belongs, has real power. It's not just a feel-good slogan.
Right. And to add to that, and we can talk more about whiteness, which I found fascinating in your talk. You said this is not, I mean, you quoted Dr. King. When he's talking about white people, he said, I'll leave the door open and I'll leave the light on. You are welcome and free to join us, but we are not going to chase you.
Right. And I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, I believe, in the circle of human concern with no one outside the circle. In fact, I would extend that circle to the earth itself. I don't think corporations should be in the circle, and I'm not anti-corporate, but I think corporations have a different function. Humans actually have a special place in our moral imagination. So I would extend that courtesy to any person, whether they're white, black, gay, straight. But if someone insists on being outside the circle, if someone insists on denying my basic humanity, if someone insists on killing other people, I think we have a right to stop that person, a right to protect ourselves, and I'm not going to chase them down. Like, if you want to have a conversation, I'm willing to have a conversation. And that's what King is saying, is that I'm not going to chase the segregationist down to try to convince him of the rights of black people. On the other hand, the door is open. I'm never going to close the door. I'm never going to turn out the light. But my goal is to, while my goal may be to include everybody, I'm focusing on the people who are most immediately affected by the negative impact of segregation. My goal is to affect everyone, but I'm focusing on the lives of black people who have been killed by the police, who have been terrorized. This is terror. You know, this is not just a killing. We have a thing called hate crime. And hate crime is when you kill someone because of their identity. It actually terrorizes the entire community, and that's what this is.
Today we are speaking with John A. Powell, Professor of Law, African American and Ethnic Studies at UC Berkeley. He's Director of the Othering and Belonging Institute at UC Berkeley, the author of many books, including Racing to Justice, Transforming Our Conceptions of Self and Other to Build an Inclusive Society. Professor Powell has done extensive work on racism here in the United States, Brazil, and South Africa. What are your thoughts on this question we're going to continue asking on this show? How can we use this moment to really create systemic change? What are your thoughts on that? What are your thoughts on what you're seeing out on the streets? These protests have now lasted 2 weeks. They are not stopping anytime soon. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Professor Powell, as you write in one of your latest pieces, we need to remember that policing is but a single component of the larger system of oppression so acutely felt in the black community. That means we also need to fight for housing justice, school reforms, integration, job opportunities, healthy neighborhoods. Professor Powell, how do we use this moment to focus on a number of issues that are all connected? Given that we are seeing such long lines at food banks, for example, like you said, so many people still don't have access to clean water in this country. How do you connect the dots when we're talking about systemic change?
So I think, you know, people will actually come to this conversation at different points. They will come in through the portal of issue that's most important to them. So if you're hungry, it's going to be food. If you have children in school, it's going to be education. If you're trying to get, if you have medical problems, but we need to do it all. And the heart of it is to understand that the country and the world, we're a society where people are first, all people, and corporations and profit are in service of people, not the other way around. You know, to say corporations make good servants, make bad masters. The fact that we have this explosion of money before the COVID crisis, and that the majority of Americans are seeing their wages stagnated. The fact that we're seeing all this new technology, and yet we watch communities crumble. We need really radical change, and radical in the best sense of the word, radical meaning taking the root cause and basically saying, we care about people, and we're a rich country, and instead what we've done is create a country where some people get a little bit more, and some people get nothing at all. And then we pit those people against each other while they lead. And I don't think all corporations are bad. I don't think, you know, you have to necessarily get rid of capitalism writ large. In fact, what we're dealing with now, it's not even capitalism. We're dealing with neo-fascism. But we can change. And I think the energy in the street shows that. But the energy in the streets does not translate into systemic changes. We have to think about institutions. It's not a coincidence that the charge against Derek for what he did was changed from manslaughter to second-degree murder. It might be changed again to first-degree murder. But it's not coincidental that Keith Ellison is the attorney general in Minnesota. Keith Ellison's a friend of mine. He's Muslim. He's African-American. And I'm not saying a white person couldn't do that, but the fact that they elected Keith Ellison to be the attorney general means that he wields institutional power that we wouldn't have unless he was in that position. And sometimes we have extreme expression of feeling, of compassion, of passion, but we don't translate it into institutions. We don't run for office. We don't get involved. And I know government is sometimes disappointing, and people say, I'm not doing that anymore. But there's no real alternative for sustained change. So we have to actually make government and the economy work for people, which means we have to have institutional strategies. So we have to do it all. And not all of us have to do it all the time, but we have to have multiple strategies. We have to think strategically, we have to plan, and we have to be engaged.
Can you talk more about the importance of politics? I was listening to a talk with Angela Davis a couple of days ago. She was on with a number of young activists, and she said, we need to talk about this upcoming election, and we need to all figure out how we want to talk about it. It's, right, what, less than 5 months away now.
That's right. Look, you know, I say to people, say, what's going to happen in the election? This is before COVID and before the uprisings that have been happening. And I said, it's very simple. We vote, we win. We don't vote, we lose. And it's not coincidental that Trump and the Republican Party is spending millions and millions, if not billions of dollars, to suppress black vote, to suppress young people, to suppress. And so I would say to people, you get engaged at every level, not just if you don't like, you know, top of the ticket, then go down ticket. You're electing judges, you're electing council members, you're electing prosecutors, you're electing, you know, so get involved. Run yourself. But who's at the top does matter. And from my perspective, a lot of people who are progressive and active have difficulty with Biden, and that's understandable. Biden doesn't have a clear progressive record. But we're not talking about a liberal versus conservative. We're talking about a moderate versus someone who's flirting with fascism. And the stakes couldn't be higher. I mean, think about it. Think about climate change, rolling back almost every regulation that he can in terms of climate change, talking about suing California so California has to allow more pollution, talking about withdrawing from the Nuclear Proliferation Pact, which is unheard of. So this administration is extremely dangerous. And yes, if we vote Democratic, wherever we vote, we should make sure the people we elect or vote for are accountable. We should hold them accountable. And if they don't respond, we should replace them. But we should not sit out. This is probably the most important election of my lifetime.
Before we go to break, Professor Pell, what concerns you the most about a possibility of 4 more years of Trump?
There are a couple of things. I think climate change is one. Obviously, racial justice is another. but also I think nuclear war. I think Trump is actually seeding a fight with China and with Iran. And, you know, the weapons of mass destruction at our disposal now is unimaginable. So I'm not sure the world would survive 4 more years of Trump.
Today we are speaking with John A. Powell, Professor of Law, African American and Ethnic Studies at UC Berkeley. He's also Director of the Othering and Belonging Institute at UC Berkeley. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about how the pandemic bailout benefited the wealthy instead of the working class. According to ProPublica, those $1,200 payouts were very, very small compared with the billions in tax breaks handed out to the country's wealthiest. We have many, many examples of this. We'll talk about tomorrow who's fighting for the working class, and then Friday it's our media roundtable. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. Today we are talking about how we can use this moment to create systemic change and ensure that all of those people that you're seeing on the streets remain energized and involved. We're talking about it with John A. Powell, Professor of Law, African American and Ethnic Studies at UC Berkeley. He's also director of the school's Othering and Belonging Institute. Professor Powell is the author of many books, including his most recent, Racing to Justice, Transforming Our Conceptions of Self and Other to Build an Inclusive Society. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. What do you make of this moment? What sort of change would you like to see? What will it take to get there? And what can we do to make sure that all of the faces you're seeing stay involved in this movement? Professor Powell, let's talk a little bit about economic issues. The Washington Post ran a piece recently saying that the gap between the finances of blacks and whites is still as wide in 2020 as it was in 1968, when a run of landmark civil rights legislation culminated in the Fair Housing Act in response to centuries of unequal treatment of African Americans in nearly every part of society. But in the decades since, white wealth has soared while black wealth has stagnated. So let's just talk about this for a little bit, Professor Powell. Talk about economics, especially when it comes to economics in black communities.
So basically, the economic system in the United States is not designed to help blacks. In fact, in many ways, it's designed to hurt it. If you look, you talked about the bailout, Rose, in terms of what's happening with COVID and where the money went. It not only went to those very rich corporations. If you're a black and in business, there's almost no chance you would get very much money. So it directed it, and sometimes it does that by writing certain rules. So you don't have to say anything about race, you just structure it so that the impact is racial. So banks lending has always been an issue in terms of redlining. Impulse not to loan money to the black and Latino community. The interest rates, the whole way that we looked at subprime lending leading up to the Great Recession, those loans were earmarked and geared toward black and Latino communities. Those were the worst loans. So it's like at every level, these sometimes small things become cumulative. And the way to address them in part, what we think about is let's stop discriminating, which we should, obviously discriminating based on race or ethnicity. But that's not enough. The system is complicated, it's structural, it's nuanced. What we need to do is to set clear goals and to affirmatively move toward those goals. And so there are literally, in any given situation, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of mechanisms in place to actually hold back the black community. And to say we're not going to discriminate, most of the time we don't even know all the ways in which we are discriminating. So it's not simply saying we want a society that's free of discrimination. We want a society that's affirmatively, proactively inclusive of all groups. And that has a very different feel to it than a society where we're not discriminating based on a person's characteristic. So, for example, yes, we have all these laws saying discrimination is illegal. And then we go look at a place and it's like they never hired a black person or they have one out of a thousand. And by all accounts, it's not that there's more people than that is qualified. So what's going on? So the anti-discrimination laws are useful, but they're very limited. And they're even less useful now because we have a government and people who are executing them who really don't care. And that's one of the frustrations also in terms of police reform. Wealth is largely accumulated through housing. And the black home ownership rate, where blacks own homes, the kind of loans they get, the kind of jobs they get, all those things actually work against the creation of black wealth. One study suggests that by 2050, based on current trends, the black wealth will be negative. Mm-hmm. The black community will have zero or negative wealth. And wealth is probably one of the most important indicators as to how well people are thriving. So we're headed in the wrong direction.
According to the census, blacks are 40% less likely to own their homes than whites. We've done so many shows about redlining and housing discrimination. And Professor Powell, we have a question from a listener about the economy. So let's go to OV in Oakland. Hi, thanks, thanks for joining us.
Yes, I would like to, I'm glad that you folks are talking about the economy. I would like to urge Professor Powell to really name the system. The system is called racial capitalism. It was based on race. The whole capitalistic system is based on race through the mechanism of African slavery, which built the wealth that made capitalism possible. And in terms of the difference between capitalism and neo-fascism, they're really the same. I heard Professor Powell say that we don't have capitalism, we have neo-fascism. Historically, neo-fascism has come up to shore up capitalism. When capitalism is in crisis, the ruling class turns to neo-fascism to save their assets, which is what's happening now. So those are very closely related. Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Powell?
Well, I appreciate the caller's question and statement. I think there's different kinds of capitalism, different kinds of markets, and neo-fascism is actually more extreme, and maybe for some people it's a distinction without a difference, but I think it is a difference. And so, for example, if you think about a country like Japan or a country like Sweden or a country like Canada, in Canada, healthcare is available to everyone. Schools are relatively expensive. My son went to school in Canada. You go to, even in places like England, police violence is minuscule compared to the United States. These are all capitalist countries. And so while capitalism may be a serious root cause, there are expressions of capitalism that are worse than better. And in the 1950s or 60s, we had capitalism, but we had a consensus that we should actually share the growth of the economy. The country was actually becoming more equal, not less equal, and the economy was growing, and it was capitalism. We changed that in the 1970s. We moved from one form of capitalism to neoliberalism, which really the work of people like Milton Friedman, which basically attacked government, which Reagan actually made famous with government's not the solution, it's the problem, but also attacked any kind of regulation and basically turned over the mantle of government to corporations. And then with the election of Trump, we moved from neoliberalism to neo-fascism, which, again, is different. So all of them may be problematic. I'm not saying certainly neoliberalism is the solution. But I worry sometimes that if we make it too broad, that if we say we can't make progress until we end capitalism, it's loading up the wagon too heavy, so we can't move. And we've seen progress. We've seen progress in the United States, and we've seen progress in other countries. Without dismantling capitalism per se, I mean, the reality is, even though it was deeply flawed and deeply racialized, the New Deal actually helped many Americans. It didn't, unfortunately, include blacks and Latinos in a robust way, but it could have, and it still would have been capitalism. It just would not have been as deeply racialized. So that's a long answer, but yes, capitalism is a problem, but we can have more or less fair systems under capitalism, or we can have something else. I'm wedded to people, not to a particular system of actually economy. I'm wedded to how do we treat people well, how do we treat people fair, and any system that does that, I think we should be willing to look at.
Well, thank you for calling in, OV. Professor Powell, since housing is so crucial, you have extensively researched the idea behind opportunity-based housing. Can you tell us what that means exactly?
Yes. So we think of oftentimes about affordable housing, which is important because, especially in the Bay Area, housing is not affordable, and we have a continuing exploding problem of homelessness and people being cramped into inadequate quarters. And so we try to say, let's build affordable housing. What we oftentimes don't pay attention to is where the housing is built. Housing is not just a place for shelter. It is that. But it also connects us to several other things. So if you have a family, the first thing is schools. So certain housing, for example, costs more because you buy into a good school district. So you're not just buying a house. You're actually buying a school district. You only have to look at a house that's close to BART and a house that's far from BART. The difference in cost would be substantial because you're buying a transportation system. If you look at where there are parks. So part of the thing is to think about when you buy housing, what are all the opportunities that are necessary for a good and flourishing life? And so when we structure the affordable housing, we should make sure that we don't once again segregate them away from opportunity. In places where there's high crime, no jobs, no food, no supermarkets, no good transportation, and so on. And so to think about housing in relationship to opportunity. And in fact, we don't do that as a country. We still, by and large, if we build affordable housing, we build it where the people are largely devoid of good opportunity, including schools, healthcare, and transportation.
Hmm. Well, and that really connects to the defund the police movement. We've done shows about this. What is missing in a lot of the mainstream coverage, especially the TV and broadcast coverage, is that the United States spends $100 billion every year on policing. And what people are calling for is to divert that money into the resources that you just described, whether it's healthy food for people, after school programs, counselors in schools. A lot of people, like, for example, here in the Bay Area in San Francisco, parents last night joined a board meeting to say the school district should cut ties with the police and instead create wellness centers in schools. So it's very connected to what you just described about housing.
Right, it is. It is. And, you know, right now we're having, I think, an important discussion on our relationship with the police. Should we fund the police, defund the police, or get rid of them altogether? I think it's really important to be clear on what we're trying to get to. The goal is we want public safety. We want well-funded communities. We want, if there are police, we want them to be responsive. We want them to actually protect and serve, not to brutalize and kill. Now, the best way to get there is complicated. There's not a single way to get there. And we need to sort of, at some point, step back and sort of think about and experiment and try different things. What people are saying, and I completely agree, is that the effort to reform the police has largely failed. We've had 30 years, if not more, of reform. Most of it wasn't tried, to be, if we're honest. So it didn't really fail. We never even got it off the ground. But be that as it may, with the police union and with retrenched police officers, and sometimes cities feel like they're hostage to the police, we have not had the kind of change necessary. So some people are saying, let's start all over again. And certainly the effort to militarize the police, to make the police more like the army, and as one of the generals said, the army is trained to kill people. That's what they do. Now, the police are not supposed to be trained to kill people. They are, but they're really supposed to be trained to serve people. So why are we militarizing the police? We're making the police worse, and then we're giving them tanks and weapons that are not appropriate for domestic. It's just, so yes, the problem is so deep that it may make sense to say, okay, we tried to fix this 5 times, 100 times. Let's start all over. And we can start in part by looking at what other countries are doing. Other countries have police or some version of that, and they don't have the kill rate that we do. They don't have the kind of, and none of them are perfect, but we are outliers. We are so much more violent and destructive, especially along racial lines, than any other country in the world.
We should also mention that last week, according to LAist, the city council introduced a motion to divert up to $150 million from police to support underserved communities. Just the city of Los Angeles spends $3 billion on the LAPD, $3 billion every year. The LA Teachers Union is also calling for disbanding the LA School Police Department.
Yes, and I've worked with some schools, and I mean, there's a lot of studies showing that police, especially police in uniform, going to schools oftentimes exacerbate the problem. They don't actually solve it. So then we need a different solution. And we should be clear, though, the police in most cities, the police represent substantial hit in the budget. But we have to bring corporations into this. We have to. The amount of money that's in this society is huge. And even if you look at what's happened since COVID, billions of dollars have been made by people who already have billions of dollars, while most people are unemployed, while most people are just getting by. So you have to include that in the mix when you're talking about the economy. Unfortunately, even though I think we overspend on the police in many cases and misspend, we can't solve that economic problem just by focusing on the police. We have to have a fair tax system. We have to have a system that a fair economic system. And while police funding is part of the problem, it's not the whole problem.
Right. And again, we're going to be talking about that issue in more detail tomorrow. Today, we are speaking with John A. Powell, professor of law, African-American and ethnic studies at UC Berkeley. We're talking about how we can use this moment to really create systemic change at a time when we are seeing people across the country take to the streets. According to Now This, actions have taken place in more than 540 cities. So many people are rising up and taking to the streets. What's happening in your community? What is the best way to really use this moment? 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's go next to GS in South Lake Tahoe. Hi, GS. Nice to hear from you.
Hello, Rose. Long time no chat. Hello, Professor Powell. It's not a simplistic suggestion, but it would make a huge difference in this country. Right now, the federal minimum wage is set at $7.25 an hour. That's only enough money for someone to make about $15 an hour. At any rate, per year, $14,000 or so. That's not enough to live on. That's poverty level. If we raise the minimum wage to at least $15 an hour, and I'd suggest even up to $20 an hour, then the minimum income in this United States for any person who's willing to work would be $30,000 an hour. $30,000
right.
Per year. If the minimum wage were raised to $20 an hour, everybody in this country who's willing to work would earn $40,000 per year. And that's enough for anybody to live well enough, buy a home and stuff like that. It would eliminate poverty. The only problem is we'd have to get there gradually because there are a lot of people out of work in small businesses if it went right to 20. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Powell, while GS was talking, I was reminded of a piece in the New York Times about what happens in Denmark where McDonald's workers make $22 an hour.
Right. Yeah, you know, and I've been a long advocate for, as my friend Wade Rasky from Acorn, paying a living wage, you know, and just indexing it, whatever. And there's work out of Boston and other places as to what a living wage is. It's not a particular, it could be $15 an hour, it could be $20 an hour. In the Bay Area, it might even be more. I would also go further, though. I would actually think about a guaranteed minimum income, because the reality is a lot of people are unemployed. A lot of people can't work. We have a lot of people with disability. And so you're being able to live, unless there's some reason, you know, if you don't want to work and you're able-bodied, that's a different thing. But we should basically say everyone's lives matter in this respect in terms of work, and that we're going to make sure that everyone, even if you don't, even if you're not in the formal workplace. The other thing is that there's certain jobs that are exempt. So restaurant workers are not covered by most minimum wage. They actually end up working on tips, which is actually a carryover from slavery. We need to change that. That actually facilitates sexual abuse, because most restaurant workers are women, and the men are paying them, and they think, okay, since I'm paying you, you know, I should be able to flirt with you. So the system is rotten in so many ways. But I think starting with raising minimum wage to $15 an hour, whatever, is a start. But really, we're trying to get to a goal, and the goal is for everyone to have enough to actually live on. And as long as they're doing their part, that if they're working, if they can work, then we should make sure that we do our part in society. And some societies do that. So it's not pie in the sky. We actually could do a universal basic income and make sure that everyone has what they need.
Well, we're going to do another show about a universal basic income. I wanted to ask you, Professor Powell, how do you think about the issues of race and class? How do you think those issues should be addressed, bringing class into the conversation?
Well, two things. One, a friend of mine, Ian Henry Lopez, wrote a book about this, basically looking at what he called race class. You have to look at them together. Mm-hmm. I wrote a long article basically saying you can't really understand class in the United States. We're not England, even though we have close ties to England. Race and class in the United States are profoundly connected, and it's hard to really, we oftentimes try to disaggregate them and almost always fail. Paul Krugman, a Nobel economist, basically said, you can't really understand the economy in the United States unless you understand race, which is not necessarily true of Denmark, or not necessarily even true of Canada. So in the United States, the way race and class is bound up, they're not the same, but they're intricately connected. And so even when something is, when we think about race, we often have to think about racialized groups. So we think about black people or Latinos. But there's a book titled Fighting Race and Class, Understanding Poverty in the United States and Europe, A World of Difference. And what these are, two economists, and what they argue is that much of the class system in the United States is really seen through the lens of race. And there's another friend, and I'm sorry to give you a reader so many books, but there's a book by David Roediger called Wages of Whiteness, is playing on a theme of W.B. Du Bois. He talks about how the construction of the white working class was animated by slavery. So again, the United States, they're deeply interconnected, and we don't appreciate it. Having said that, I think it's also important to sort of figure out ways to bridge the life and the concerns of the white working class, black working class, and racial justice. And I don't think that should be hard, but I think we should need to do more work in terms of bridging those.
Yeah, this is so important. This is what the Reverend William Barber talks about so much, is he's doing lots of work in coal country, lots of work in Kentucky, and connecting those people with people living in the Mississippi Delta.
That's right. I was on a call earlier, just before I got on a call with you, and someone asked me about affirmative action. And hopefully it's coming back in a different form to California and other places. I think there are 8 states that don't allow race-based affirmative action right now. And part of the thing I guess I would advise us to look at is to combine race and class-based affirmative action. So, you know, when we push for race-based affirmative action, they'd always say, what about white people in Appalachia, you know? And my response is, yeah. You know, they have intergenerational poverty. They have a low mortality rate, morbidity rate. They die, guys in the coal mine oftentimes die of in their 40s. They have bad health outcomes. So yeah, we need to do, you know, now the reality is that the majority of people who are at the intersection of intergenerational poverty, segregation, discrimination, the majority of them are people of color and the majority of them are black. But where others are experiencing the same kind of dispossession, bring them in. We don't want anyone left behind.
Final thoughts, Professor Powell, on where we are at this moment. And this is going to continue. Like I said, I just looked at the list of protests in the next 5 days, and the list is very, very long. Where do you see, in terms of keeping the momentum going, what are your thoughts on that?
I guess I'll say two things. One, you know, things will become normalized. People will, you know, maybe with Japan and Hong Kong, which has been protesting for a year, but most likely not. I mean, we did that in Ferguson some. It's hard to sustain it. People have eventually have to go back to work. So we need to have protests, you know, sort of strategically, but also other ways of actually expressing our concern and figuring out how to actually make the kind of changes in our budgets, to make the kind of changes in our police, to make the kind of changes in our education system. So there has to be multiple strategies. The expression of demonstrating on the streets, I think, is really, really important. That's the energy behind it. But it is hard to sustain. So I think we have to think about what are some of the other institutional things we might do as well. And one of them, I mean, come October or November, we're going to be in the midst of an election. There should be a lot of energy for that. So I'm hoping that we take advantage of that energy and get people engaged civically in an ongoing way.
John Powell is professor of law, African American, and ethnic studies at UC Berkeley. Professor Powell, thank you so much for all of your incredible work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.